I'll sail down the street in my new fancy car. I will rise through the buildings to the sky like a star. There's a house in Eden, even though I've lost my way, and I'll be there shortly. This is just a brief delay. You're listening Atoms, Motion, and the Void on New Hampshire Public Radio. Roll down the window and breathe in the air. Blow out there. There's a house in Eden, and I think I'm on my way, and I'll be there shortly. This is just a brief delay. I was walking alongside the mountain river, down through the darkness. The sky was an ice-colored ruffled block. No moon or stars. Just a gloomy, hanging fluorescence. A cold, smudging sort of evening that makes you feel like your eyes aren't open. It was late October, 2 days before Halloween, and it was cold. I was a little underdressed in my black suit, but I was moving swiftly and keeping warm. I wear an old miner's headlamp when I walk at night. It burns a roughly fragrant oil that sets out an orange, gentle light. As the oil burns, this kind of sooty rope of smoke swirls around me with an agreeable scent of train tracks. It's a bit as though there's a pleasing little locomotive puffing around my forehead, sending down this rich smoke. It's 2 miles or so in total to the Macaw Meadows, down the mountain, past the old abandoned house, and thence along the bridle path to the open farmlands. There is one dismal spot. Oh, not dismal, just troubled. After the path finally crosses the river at the shoals, and one begins to decline toward the meadow, one comes upon an old wreck of a fallen-down house. You might not even see it as you pass, so wild is the growth of young trees and bushes surrounding it. But here, 100 years ago, the forebears of my closest neighbour, Seamus Dunn, lived. They made boots for the army and shoes for the local gentry, and did a general custom in costumes. Seamus's mother passed away young, but his father continued on in the house until 15 or 20 years ago. I met him once, a wild old man with white hair and a long white beard, much like my own countenance nowadays, I should imagine. After his father died, Seamus tried to get rid of the house, to no avail. I went, quite by accident, to a rather private estate sale. I was out on the paths, as I often am. Seamus was packing up the sellable items to be hoisted down to a local auction house. He let me browse among the things as he went in and out of the house. There was a pile of vintage clothing and some good but ancient tools. It's where I found the miner's headlamp. And, as I'm thinking of it, I believe I got my black suit there, and the shoes too. Part of my elderly maneuvering includes checking certain key things in advance of their use. Thus, the principal purpose of my evening walk tonight was a little due diligence on my parade outfit, as I called it, the terrible black wool jacket and matching pants and pair of black shoes, which once belonged to Seamus Dunn's father. When I finally exited the forest and began across the fields, it was nearing midnight. The rigid, ice-colored clouds had broken, and the moon paddled light over the mountains. I reached out my hands to brush the cold, dead, yellowy shafts of the straw in the meadowland. Much of the field had been threshed, and there were great wheels of hay toppled about. When I reached the rock wall, I turned to head back home. I was relieved to see the mild, lumpen shapes of the storage boxes set out against the meadow. The volunteers would be here tomorrow to assemble the fairgrounds. And then, in 2 days' time, on Halloween, the town of Lemmon would gather here to celebrate its annual Demon of Lemmon Festival. There are tents and games and assorted spooky things, terrifying noises, dunking booths, gaming parlours, and every kind of sweet and meaty snack. At any rate, my parade outfit was hanging in there, the festival preparations were underway, and so I turned on my heels, ready to head home, when I heard and felt the softest, most troubling ripping tear, as of a thick wet book being sundered quietly in the soil beneath my feet. I cranked the miner's lamp to full and gazed down to discover that my left shoe had figured in a massive blowout. I took a gentle, hopeless step to test if the carnage might somehow undestruct itself. But the upper then severed free, and the clunky leather sole tumbled into the weeds, and looked, at that moment, like the most perfect little picture of a murdered footstep. I listened for quite some time to the cricket worry and my own. The leather collar of my old left shoe was hung round my ankle like a lampshade, my socky foot directly on the wet yellow grasses of the field. What is it, I wondered, that a person does in the cold night time when one shoe goes bad in the middle of nowhere? It's something along the lines of a flat tire. I should say here that I suffer from hypnopompic episodes. I'm an inveterate sleepwalker, and one of the things I was doing now in the field was attempting to verify my current state. Was I awake or asleep? For the curious experience of the sleepwalker is that they are semi-conscious, partly awake and partly asleep. Because of this, they are subject to both auditory and visual hallucination. Sleepwalkers may even wonder, as I was, whether or not they are sleepwalking. They may even dismiss the idea while great vast illusions swirl all around them. I returned my attention to the worry tending my broken shoe. At such moments of anxiety, I tend to check my pockets. And here would be another clue as to my state. If I was sleepwalking now, I might expect to find a cobbler's tool in my pocket, or even a spare shoe. Yet there was nothing in my pockets but a terribly old piece of hard candy stuck down in the bunching vertex of my pants pocket. I pried it out and then accidentally drew my sticky fingers along the jacket, leaving a smear of candy. I sighed at my recklessness. So it was that my shoe, my jacket, my pants, my entire parade outfit had all been vexed in a quick minute, attacked on the one hand by candy and on the one foot by time. I removed the sad leather cowl of the left shoe and then took off the right. Shoes in hand, I was about to depart when across the distance, Seamus and Maggie Dunn's white farmhouse caught my eye. Like his father and grandfather before him, Seamus was a cobbler. In addition, they ran an informal laundry service from their home. I could leave my things at the drop-off station on their porch, and they would certainly have me back in business in time for the Demon of Lemon Festival. I crept along the porch, dropped my pants casually to the floor, removed my jacket, and hung my suit on the iron hooks, and then carefully laid the wreckage of my shoes in the box at the bottom. I suppose I must have some tendency not to see the far side of certain of my efficient solutions, as it hadn't occurred to me, but that, of course, this one resolution created a fresh different problem, for I would now be walking home like this, barefoot, and in the yellow antiquities of my undershirt and undershorts.
As I'm walking, I know I'm not breathing. I'm not breathing, only air. 'Cause it's filled with words once spoken by people. Hear all the whispers that have lived a thousand years. It just took me being open for them to read. Now they've reached my
bigger ear.
I slipped down the farmhouse stairs. I could go back the way I came, but that would entail a very public walk across the Macaw Meadows. It was late, but an occasional car could still quite reasonably rumble past on the meadow road. Quicker and safer to continue up the ridge and then over the crest to rejoin the bridle path on the far side. The trail up was steep, and my feet were numb with the cold. Here and there a heavy log had been battered into the dirt to serve as a kind of step. Huffing and growing colder by the minute, I began to skirt across the flat rocks of the high cliff. My hands were surprisingly warm, gripping around the bold black socks. As the wind blew across the escarpment, I stretched the thin socks over my arms, like impromptu sleeves, like these kinds of mittens for awful people. I stood for a moment, looking out from the bald ridge, down toward the Macaw Meadows. Strangely, I saw now that some of the tents had somehow been set up in the interim of the last few minutes. I hadn't heard anything, nor could I see any of the workmen. In addition, the shadowy team of draft horses now stood midfield. They chuffed darkly near their stalls, quietly shrugging at the cold. On Halloween night, they'd be suited up with a train of wagons. As many as 50 adults and children would then go bumping around the circumference, maybe a mile distance in all, on the hayride. But most of the festival goers, me included, just wait and watch, looking up toward the spot where I was now standing on the bald ridge. For when the hayride draws finally alongside the meadow's near edge below, the driver will halt the horses, and the riders will shift their gaze toward the bald ridge. Seamus Dunn, leaning from his porch, will hammer the bell on his railing, and all of us, in helpless unison, will stare upwards to this bald ridge where, once upon a time, the demon of Lemon made his first and last appearance. A glowing, awful, shouting ghost of some indescribable sort. Even for the old skeptics like me, there's something about the ritual that makes it seem, each year, a little more possible that the apparition will appear to raise his spooky arms and perhaps shout out some incantation. A cool fog swooped over the rocks, and my feet felt the ice afresh. The orange lamplight glowed along the falling lace, and I reached down into this lace, quite gratified to find the edges of my sheets. So pleased, in fact, that I did not bother to wonder why my bedding had been delivered along in the arriving ripple of mist out here on the bald ridge. Regardless, I tugged the blankets upwards from the rocks and the moss and the mist and drew the covers all around me in a lazy flop as the fog and the rocks and the cold night air all vanished in the shadowy frame of my bedroom, and I fell into the nearest void of sleep.
Rock my boat, cold waves sway amid the mist.
following afternoon. The sun ran and poked and fished through the branches of the trees. Today, the plan was simple enough, to don my parade outfit for a bit of due diligence, to make sure it could withstand another outing. I turned on the mattress, bringing the sheets all with me. I could feel a hardship in my body now, and a constriction at my forearms. I rolled over a shoulder and loomed upward into standing. The sheets went like water to the floor, and a huge ache followed my body. Most shockingly, I discovered that some accident of movement had brought my black dress socks up and over my arms. And worse, the socks were not clean, as my nose had the misfortune to discover. I prized the socks from my arms and went to the closet, reaching into the dark recesses for the hard old vinyl bag where I stored my parade outfit. But its familiar bulk was missing. I tugged the bulb chain and then entered alongside my cool shirts and pants. But the clothing bag wasn't there. I glanced around the room nervously. The socks on the arms had been a dead giveaway. And there it was, more proof. In the corner of the room, unzipped and empty, my clothing bag. I sighed at the trouble I'd been making for myself with these outings. My somnambulism had returned with a vengeance. For 60 years or so, I've been untroubled by any nocturnal mischief. But I had been waking these last weeks more frequently than not to find strange dislocations in my cabin. Sandwiches half made on top of the radio, the doors all wide open, clothing strewn about. It was like living with a crackpot version of oneself. My Mr. Hyde was not wicked. He was just terribly untidy. I went to the kitchen, put some toast on and lit the flame for tea. There was very little I could do about the missing parade outfit. It's a lot like losing a wallet when you just absently placed it somewhere bizarre. Not thinking, just pushing it between a pair of books, as though that's where it should go. A sleepwalker's logic is similar, and especially woeful. The only thing I could do was to fumble over the remembered images of my dreams. For here, at least, there might be some clue as to my last night's activities. So I sipped my tea and ate the toast and struggled after the fleeting pictures I'd woken with, of the abandoned house in the woods, of the macaw meadows. There was a cold pressure at the windows, and the light outside was already yellow and black. I went to the wood stove and stoked the embers with the poker, and threw on some fresh wood, opened the flue until the fire roared. I went to my closet and drew on some comfortable clothes. Sat on the bed and pulled on my fleece pants, which is when the miner's headlamp rolled against my hip. I didn't need any more proof that I'd been sleepwalking, but the fact of the miner's headlamp established that I'd left the cabin and gone for a solid wandering. For whatever reason, my sleeping self had some affinity for the old dim lantern. As evening was coming on, I looked for, and failed to find, the small flashlight that I carry with me when I go out as an awake person. I looked in the trash and then in the toilet. The tandem contrast of my affinity for the miner's lamp is my deep and abiding hatred for flashlights. At least as a sleepwalker, I cannot stand them, and will destroy or dispose of them if I can. I drew on a winter coat and reluctantly lit the miner's lamp before cabling it up over my head. I made a quick cheese sandwich, took a stack of crackers, and I stowed these, along with a flask of whiskey, in the very large, flappy side pocket of my big coat. The dusky sky was a rotten, brownish purple. I cut toward the break in the trees and then turned along with the trickling river down toward the shoals. There was only a twinge of light prying the sky when I pushed into the thicket at the edge of the old estate. I stepped on the patches of grass in respect to their former status, as though to honour the home as a home, not just beams and nails sinking slowly into the wilderness. Once inside the ramshackle home, I probed around for my suit. I turned the lamp to full and searched the cupboards. There were leaves and sticks scattered everywhere on the wooden floor and bits of glass. Signs of animals coming and going, some empty beer cans. Near the front door, at the bottom of the rotten stairs, is a tipsy chair and old crate. I sat on the chair and set my supper on the box. I ate hungrily and sipped from the flask. Alcohol was contraindicated for the sleepwalker, so the doctor says. That among a dozen or so other pleasures. For some time as I ate, I'd been hearing the scratch and bother of a small animal, a raccoon or squirrel, perhaps even a deer, rustling in the leaves around the house. This persisted for the course of my meal, but then, distinctly, upsettingly, the sound shifted. Not at all the sound of a nocturnal creature crunching over the fall leaves. Oh no, it was the sound of a shovel, digging. You're listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on New Hampshire Public Radio. I bolted up from the chair and pressed myself to the wall. After a moment's close scrutiny to see if my movement had been detected, I leaned out the empty door space, peering down the length of the house, where I saw the heart-pounding figure of a man kicking a shovel into the soil. There were two small wooden boxes in the grass at his feet, and on top of one of these lay a flashlight, which sent a weak spray of light at the targeted excavation. The man dug for a while, and then sat down on his knees, and thereupon shifted the two boxes into the hole. He pressed them down, and then levelled his arm through the hill of soil and covered them. He patted the loose soil down, and then stood and stomped across the little plot, and then scuffed some leaves across the top, as though returning the aggravated location to a somewhat natural look. He lifted up his shovel and flashlight, and came slowly toward the house. I flattened against the interior wall, my heart in four furies as to what might happen next. The flashlight pierced through the front door and painted wildly over the walls. The man stepped up on the jamb and balanced there, then carved the silver light along the walls, over the now empty chair, to the crate, where a few crackers and the half-eaten sandwich lay. I winced especially, seeing the old silver flask standing open next to the piece of sandwich. The man took one step in and reached for the crackers. He pressed them down, testing their freshness. He then grabbed the sandwich and smelled it and squeezed the soft bread. Food left behind, even fresh food, might indicate a recent visitor. But the flask was not something to be left behind. He brought the flask to his nose and sniffed it. Then he rotated it around until he could see the three ornate initials carved on the front side. And then he put the flask down and backed away. Hope that does it for you, Dad. Seamus Dunn's quiet voice spoke. His flashlight hovered around a last moment before swinging away. I listened to the departing footsteps and then stepped to the door to watch Seamus walking away down the dark path toward his home. Slowly, so quietly and reluctantly, I drifted toward the side yard where Seamus had buried his boxes. I knelt in the dirt and brushed aside the leaves. My hands went into the dirt. It was so soft and easy, and I could already feel the corner of one of the boxes. But I stopped to turn up the headlamp, when in the fresh illumination, my eye caught sight of these dark, toppling old boulders in a kind of pattern through the woods. I evaluated these briefly before sitting back, defeated. I pushed the little feature of dirt I'd managed back into place, scattered some leaves, and then brushed my hands free of the dirt. I could not overlook this. These rocks stopped me, for I was not just sitting in a side yard, but in the Dunn family cemetery. The stones, 9 of them, engraved with arrival and departure dates, were scattered between the saplings in the woods here. The nearest stone belonged to Seamus's father, Thomas Wentworth Dunn, born 1807, died 1989. So a family plot straddling the old Dunn homestead. I could not trespass here, in this most sacred spot, where Seamus looked after his family and kept such mysterious boxes, and where presumably he and his wife Maggie would someday, shortly be. I went back inside to get the flask. I had no idea why Seamus had not gone searching the house for the flask's owner, but then I lifted it, took a small sip, and then looked at the flowery initials of the previous owner. T.W.D. Not only had I gotten the headlamp and the parade outfit from the estate sale, I'd also gotten myself a useful flask.
Time will slow you down. If you're lucky, a chance to be ground to the earth, the wind playing with your sands before you leave this land. Impatience kills good cheer. Slow down, slow down.
I was then heading to the Dunn's farmhouse, by way of the upper path, rather than across the McCaw Meadows, as another fragment of my dream included a view from the top of the bald ridge. Through the spaces and the trees, as I rose, I could see the white tops of the assembled tents. There were trucks in the field, and men still working in the darkness, racing against time, as was the usual case. There was the occasional sound of mallets striking iron stakes and of truck doors shutting hard. The path grew wider as I approached the bald ridge. The white rocks glowed bluish in the moonlight. I stepped carefree out onto the slab, but came to a quick halt when I saw Seamus Dunn standing 20 yards ahead and somewhat higher up on the ledge. I backed slowly into the woods, extinguishing the flame and the lamp, as Seamus turned and looked down at the meadows, as though seeking a reference point. He surveyed and then crossed along the rocks, scanning for something, as though he'd lost his watch, and then he glanced higher, and with some effort, using his hands in places, began to rise up the ledges. Because of our uncomfortable close call at the house, it seemed an unpleasant prospect to now meet up with him here. So when he disappeared behind some rocks, I slipped out over the ridge and crossed to the path on the far side. I descended quickly down the trail, which spills out and dies about 30 yards from the Dunn's farmhouse. I drew past the house and then stopped in a corner of the field. As the moon was up and bright, I removed the headlamp and slipped it into my pocket as the last of the men packed up their things. It was probably 9 o'clock or so.
"Sherwin, come over."
The soft voice of Maggie Dunn reached for me. I turned round. She beckoned me from the porch. I waved and moved with some reluctance toward her.
"See Seamus up there?"
she asked lightly. "I should think about some climbing rope for that one," I said, as cheerfully as I could.
"He's half-goat," she said, unconcerned. "Come sit. They've got the tents up. It's so nice they're done. Last year they were here till midnight. So now, guess who saw a ghost last night?"
Maggie, and Seamus for that matter, were all the time coming at you with this sort of rhetoric, where you were never lost for the answer.
"You?" I guessed.
"Me?" Maggie said, nodding and smiling happily.
"Can you believe it? I don't even believe in ghosts. Still don't. Is that possible? Hard to undo a lifetime of thinking one way about it."
"The demon of Lemon, was it?" I wondered, half joking. "Oh, I know you don't believe it," she said.
"That's fine. I don't either. But let me tell you. Guess who also had a late-night visitor in addition last night?"
"You?" I guessed again.
"About midnight. I heard something scratching around on the porch, like someone's dropping off their laundry like the old days. But since we retired, we don't get those noises anymore, thank God. But last night, I swear, someone's out there." "Who is it, Seamus?" I said. "Who doesn't know we're retired?" Seamus grumbled. He wouldn't even wake up, so I peek out the window, and I don't see anything. And then, for extra safety, I go have a peek up the bold ridge. It's just a bad habit when I get up for a scare, because of the history, because who knows? But I look last night, and don't I see the vaguest something or other up there? So I call out to Seamus, "Come look, come look!" And he's so slow to come that he barely gets a glimpse of my ghost. And then he, who only had this tiny glimpse, says, "That's no ghost. It's a man in his undies." And he heads right back to sleep, as though that's what we always have on the cliff, an underwear man on the ridge. So I go to bed mad. Next morning, I'm giving him the silent treatment. And then all of a sudden, guess who starts bellowing, because he found an old black suit and some old shoes on the porch?
Seamus, I guessed.
"Like we're not retired 10 years already, someone leaving their laundry for us, but I'm still giving him the silent treatment. And then he's calling for me, but I won't budge, and then he finds me and he says in a hush, 'It's the suit I buried Dad in, and the shoes too, Maggie.' And oh my, did our eyes go starry bright. 'That was my father last night that we saw on the ridge,' Seamus says, 'bringing us his graveyard clothes to wash and shoes to mend.'"
An uncomfortable heat was rising at my collar. "I see," I said. "And how will Seamus's father come to fetch these clothes?" Not only was I deeply discomforted by the story, I was also trying to find some way that my parade outfit could return to my possession.
"Well, he buried the suit and shoes up at the gravesite," Maggie said, matter of fact, as though this is what anyone would do.
"Good thinking," I said.
"And now he's up on the high ledge there, with a cheese sandwich and some crackers.
I see, I said, and what would be the point of that?
Seamus couldn't stand his father, if you remember. You met him, I think. A mean old bully, terrible, bossy man. Seamus wouldn't talk to him at the end, and there was this sort of rift. But still, we had to take care of him, family and everything, which means food and care. So Seamus would bring over meals and things. So hard on him, for the abuse he'd get every time. And the night before his father died, he ordered Seamus to bring him up supper, and Seamus didn't, for spite, to show that that's not how he should be treated. And then the old man died, and there was this black guilt that came to Seamus, so deep and black, this pain in him, which he couldn't even talk about. So what it is now is to get that closure around it. That's what it is now. Closure is what's happening for Seamus, with the return of old Thomas Wentworth Dunn. Maggie was pleased. She'd come to the word closure that described it. This is the peace of their mutual forgiveness. Him to his father to him, she said, under her breath, as though it was not really a part of the story, or something she wished to share. That's what Seamus says of it anyway, that this is the peace of their forgiveness. I had had a steadily and complexly growing sense of distress. I was bothered deeply by the treacherous results of my sleepwalking. I had obviously come to the Duns, left my clothing for their tending, gone up onto the Bald Ridge, in my underclothes, where the Duns had mistaken me for a ghost, for the ghost of Thomas Wentworth Dunn. Yet at the same time, I wanted my suit back, my shoes. I wanted to instantly erase this whole ghost business, show or tell them that it was me. But how? I knew only that it was wrong, however accidentally, through the agency of a semi-conscious state, to have misled them into thinking that Thomas Wentworth Dunn was walking around looking to make peace with his son and have cheese sandwiches and have his shoes cobbled and his suit cleaned. I should go, I said. My hands were flush. The miner's lamp and the flask were guilty lumps in my pockets.
You'll come tomorrow? Maggie asked.
Wouldn't miss it. My voice quavered with what was almost verging now on shame. Hello to Seamus for me, I muffled quietly. I tipped my head and waved awkwardly and started down the porch stairs. The night rolled with itself, the black of space, the point of star, the loose light edges of the crescent moon. I couldn't see him, but I could hear Seamus scrambling over the ledges above, in the knocking of the rocks and the small avalanches, positioning the awful cheese sandwich as a token symbol, of his side anyway, of the mutual forgiveness. At home, I sat collapsed and lowly in my broken thought streams. I had a drink from Thomas Wentworth Dunn's flask, and then another, all the while faintly wondering how to recover my parade outfit from the Dunn family cemetery without becoming the grave robber that I must for doing so. Could I just fetch it back? Wear it, even? Maybe wait a year or two? My eyes began to close. If I wore a strange colored shirt, if I changed the laces of the shoes, if my bow tie was phosphorescent, spectacular, striking, enormous. My thoughts dimmed around an imagined exchange of Maggie and Seamus greeting me on their porch, not at all noticing that I was wearing the outfit of the long-dead man, of the freshly laundered, freshly buried suit and cobbled shoes, the headlamp glowing at my forehead, handing the flask to Seamus, finding my own peace and closure in this rift my sleepwalking self had fashioned for me to seal.
hungry and cold. I had the sense that I could look inside and see the steep, dark pit of my enormous appetite. I went into the living room. It was evening yet again, I supposed. There was a dim crackling of light through the windows. I lit the headlamp and drew the straps below my chin, and in the rosy light I now noticed the small, peg-like stairs bolted to the wall of my cabin. I had almost completely forgotten about the storage loft on the second level. The steps were so thin and small that years could pass without my thinking of them. I set my foot on the bottom peg and tested the second. There was no railing, and these steps were just wide enough for a single foot. I remembered happily, as I rose up the pegs, that I kept my holiday snacks up there in the loft, set out on a waiting arrangement of plates. I moved as quickly as I could up the tiny stairs, and I smiled as I stepped into the familiar, soft loam of the loft. It's so easy to forget that the floor up there is made of dirt. I had plans to put in a garden, but no one could quite tell me the best kind of indoors crop for a second level. I knelt down into the dirt and began to dig. I'd been keeping my parade outfit buried in the earth for many years now. It's the best way to make an old outfit last. I skivvied out the wooden boxes, gratified to find things as I'd hoped. The dark wool jacket and pants were actually improved by this special keeping. I drew on the pants and coat and tied the shoes, and then gazed upward at the toppled pile of my storage. It occurred to me that I might do a bit of due diligence and take the parade outfit for a trial run, make sure things were holding together. But I was still hungry, and recalled that my snacks were actually further up in the small second loft area. So I began to climb up into the pile, stepping over the old boxes of clothes, the hard shapes of this and that. I could smell the hot sweet cider wafting down from my snack area. I loved that I maintained this snack section for myself. There was a faint smoke now, too, of hamburgers and a rising warm wind of cotton candy. I looked back down into the distance below me. I could see the smooth white tents and the glorious lights of the festival. The cold night made the horses' breath shoot out in tendrils of smoke as they led the trains of hay-spilling wagons round the circumference of the field. I reached upward and took hold of the ledge and drew myself to the very highest place in the cabin, a dark little nook up below the stars. I sat in the victory of my ascension, like the king of the night, peering down at the gathered throng, the happy Halloweening citizens of Lemon. I would have my supper, and then off along the paths I'd race, to be there just in time to join in the great observation of the Bald Ridge. I reached out for the cheese sandwich set on the plate before me on the flat rock, and drew the flask from my pocket. I felt so lucky to have remembered these snacks, and not only to have the food, but to be able to see the festivities from this vantage in the loft. A bell rang out from the McCaw Meadows, and the horses halted in their traces at the bottom of my view. And then there came the most curious, oceanic stillness and silence. I felt I knew what this was, but I couldn't quite place it. I looked at the flask and rubbed my thumbnail at the initials. T.W.D. Thomas Wentworth Dunn. Something was happening, and I would remember in a moment. I reached for the lamp on my head and turned it to full, and the orange light came bright and rosy all around with the falling, sweet rough scent of train tracks from the oil as it burned. And then, there he came, Running down the porch steps into the middle of the field, out near the horses, staggering and pointing. I heard him call up to me, and I raised my hands. "I see you, Seamus," I called. "Can you see me?" But my voice, I don't know. It was soft and drawn down against the wind at the roof of the cabin. I was so far away and so tired. This is the peace of our forgiveness, son. I heard myself shouting out over the fields. The ceiling of the cabin roof above me opened, and the stars came whipping down, and I was running along the rocky crest, with the points of the night catching along at me, like black bats exchanging me for darkness. I dashed through the forest, that I would make it back down into the dirt before he arrived. I collapsed near the burial hole, set the suit and shoes in the wooden boxes, and buried them down into the earth. I could see Seamus now, running over the bridle path, his flashlight beam like a sword of light cutting every tree. I set the flask and the old miner's headlamp on the earth for proof, and I then spilled down myself into the cool dirt and rolled across the land, with the dirt flying upward and closing my eyes and mouth as I reached out to pull the long, dark cloak of the earth around my shoulders, that when he arrived a moment hence to look, he would find only this peaceful, quiet semblance of the earth, with the miner's lamp and the flask on top, troubled over here and there with the small brown hands, the scattered leaves.
Seven is seven, is 27, is 48, is 44.
44.
It was a cold night, a wicked evening, and I was trying to get a lift. The decorations of the building lights like a swollen landing strip. Then conceiving, I found some leaves that I wanted, pressed and tried. The hands wouldn't let me work that night. I decided not to try. I went to Bright Street, I went in bare feet, I went to Barron's, shoes and ties. There were streamers up, they won't let you browse, hence I lied.
77 is 27, is 48, is 44. Seven is seven, is 27, is 48, is 44.
44.
The wooden ceilings, the broken windows, the curtains drawn and torn. These old motels like sunken ships still crashing on the shore. There's a bird in the deep footprint in the snow outside the door. I'd feed her if the shoe'd been mine. At Barron's I was declined. So I'm holed up for the winter in this broken down motel. I wrote to Cat to catch her up. Yes, I wrote, I'm well. There's a song of the fair traveller who rambles free and wide. I'm just like that, I wrote to Cat. Hence I lied.
77.
You've been listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on New Hampshire Public Radio. For more information on the show, please visit www.nhpr.org or my own website at www.radioghost.com.